Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Yeah, I'm Rhett Prof.
And I'm John Burdick. And we're you're listening to the Sundance Reel here on KPCW.
So yeah, Sundance Reel on the weekend. And we're bringing in many talented filmmakers from the 2020 Sundance Film Festival. So we're starting off this morning with director Ramona Diaz, who is here with the U.S. Documentary Competition with a film called A Thousand Cuts, which is set in the Philippines. And Ramona, is, we not only have the director, we have the central figure of the film,
Maria.
Maria Ressa?
Yes.
The description of a president of the Philippines with his idea of an anti-drug campaign, an anti-journalism campaign, and John, you got
Duterte, right? Is the president?
Yes, President Duterte.
Duterte, and an amazing film. So thank you for being here at KPCW, and thank you, Maria. Inspiration to local news outlets all over the place. I've seen the film, so let's get our listeners a little bit of a synopsis of this film so that we can understand why I just made that comment.
Yeah, so really, the film is a look at President Duterte in the Philippines in really roughly the year 2018 through 2019. It does flashbacks to 2016. But really, the film is about the erosion of democracy, told through the lens of one journalist, with Maria's lens, and through the prism of press freedom.
Yes. And can you talk a little bit about your press outlet in the film and just where that, I mean, because obviously you have gone through a lot for this particular free press.
It's been an incredible 3 years for us, right? Duterte was elected in May 2016. A month later, you had Brexit, and then the dominoes began to fall. I think this shows you exactly how what is happening on social media. Networks of disinformation are attacking people at a very micro targeting people at a very visceral level and pounding open issues of identity to polarize society. And in doing that, you're moving them to essentially to lose the facts, right? So if you don't have facts, everything else in a democracy crumbles. What we've lived through shows is that our dystopian present, because we have a government that has killed thousands, by its own admission, thousands of people, by human rights groups, it's tens of thousands, at least 27,000 people in 3 years. So you have that impunity in the drug war, the violence and fear, and then simultaneously the impunity of disinformation, of manipulating people. And, you know, this is a story that is very familiar here in the United States. Our dystopian present is your dystopian future if you don't do anything about it, because it's partly American social media platform's fault.
Right, definitely. In listening this or watching this documentary, you were able to show a number of your interviews with the president. You also talked about his upcoming and running on the platform of ending the war on drugs. Can you talk to a little bit about that and his and how he came to power? And
I think he. I don't believe ending the war on drugs. He insists that, you know, he will fight the war on drugs till the very end of his term, right?
He's not going to give up. What I meant by that was killing every drug.
Exactly.
You know, you made the list and you're done.
Exactly. He wasn't going to let up until every drug pusher and every drug killer, until he got all of them. Yeah, so the rise of Duterte, you know, I watched it from, I live in the U.S., and I'm Filipino-American, but I live between these spaces, right? This liminal space between the Manila and in Baltimore. I live in Baltimore. And I was watching his rise to power, and I was like, it was incredible to me, and I couldn't quite believe it. So this film for me was a search trying to understand his rise in the Philippines, really. All my films are really explorations, right? And trying to ask the right questions. So, and then I think right about, when was that, July 2016, I started seeing all these horrific pictures on my Facebook page on the drug war. And I then you can't turn away, right? As a documentary filmmaker, I built a career on telling stories about the Filipino and Filipino American experience to a Western audience, right? So this was a story that I couldn't not do, because it was horrific. So, you know, then I went to research. It was just this vague idea about Duterte and the drug war. I had no idea I was going to tell it through Maria's story until, you know, I met Maria.
Yeah, I was going to say, how did you guys meet? I mean, did she reach out to you? Did you reach out to her?
Oh, no, she did not reach out to me.
Okay, there's something back there.
Yeah, I mean, I was on the ground. I was in Manila in 2018. I was talking to a lot of people in the administration, people in the opposition. And then I thought, you know, I should really talk to someone in the press. And of course, the loudest voice then that was going up against President Duterte was Rappler, and was Maria, you know, and Rappler. So I asked, I think Sheila Coronel, who is the dean of journalism at Columbia, who is an advisor in the film, to introduce us. So she introduced us. I met with Maria and asked her to be part of the film. It was supposed to be this ensemble cast, right?
Right.
But one thing led to another. She got we finally landed in the Philippines for principal photography the day before her arrest. So, like, the day after she's arrested, I'm at...
That was your first day on the ground? Was it the day after that she got off the plane?
No, we had already filmed some with her. But, you know, the principal, when we committed to the long haul, right?
Gotcha.
So I landed February 12th. She got arrested February 13th.
So how convenient for your film. I mean,
right?
I'm sorry.
It was bad for her. Right. But, you know, I always say what's good for the film is not necessarily good for the person you're filming.
The subject, yes.
Yeah.
I understood.
So, and then one thing led to another. Then she was arrested again. And then at some point, she just allowed us access to everything. That's why I always say I know all the secrets of Rappler.
Can you talk about some specific, you know, instances of disinformation being put out? You know,
that would be a Maria question. Yeah. That's
maybe a little history for our listeners about Rappler and the site that you, I mean, the whole news outlet that you have.
Sure. So this year I would have been a journalist for almost 35 years. And I spent 20 of those years running Southeast Asian bureaus for CNN. And then when I turned 40, I said I was going to go home. I chose home. Home was the Philippines. And I headed the largest news group in the Philippines for 6 years. And then technology really was the one. I thought, oh my gosh, we're missing it. Because legacy news groups create systems for efficiency, not necessarily for to be agile and to be able to pivot. So in 2012, I left running a news group of 1,000 people, more than 1,000, that was global for the Philippines, to begin Rappler, which is a startup if you look at it, right? We started with 12 people in a year and a half because we embraced the technology, social media in particular. We became the third top online news site in the Philippines. And that was the power. So what we did, I always say, what's Rappler for? We build communities of action. Because I've been a journalist for a long time and I'm tired of throwing stories into a black hole. I wanted to understand how we can use the technology for impact. But the first few years was amazing in terms of what we were able to do. We were able to do a disaster risk reduction platform with social media. We were able to combine bottom up and top down. The Philippines at that point was the third most disaster prone country. Climate change was one of our main issues. And we have an average of 20 typhoons every year. And so we were able to get communities together to work together when typhoons were happening. But in 2015, when Facebook took instant articles and asked news groups to come in, that changed everything, right? And specific instances of disinformation, a ton. In 2016, all of a sudden, it was the use of anger and hate. And what we began to see after President Duterte was elected, so just some background, the Filipinos spend the most time online and the most time on social media globally.
Really?
100% of Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. Facebook is our internet. And what began to happen was we began to see that lies laced with anger and hate spread fastest on social media, an easy one. Instead of me being a journalist, right? They replaced journalists with criminal, tax evader. You say it, you pound it a million times, that becomes the fact. So to some Filipinos, I'm just a criminal. And it was very easy. I watched these, another one, I'm CIA. Good God, yeah, right? Yeah, you know? Yeah. And that I'm out to this one, the government. This came from the presidential palace that I'm out. I'm plotting to oust the government. Good God, I would love to have my military do that. You know, it's like, but all of this was an attempt to stop us from reporting. You know, in 2018, when Ramona was there, we had almost a case a month thrown at us. And in 2019, I had to post bail 8 times. In order to be here, I had to post more than $60,000, you know, in bail and bonds. And that's more than Imelda Marcos, who's been convicted, has had to do, right? So being a journalist, I guess part of why we became targeted is I know the standards, the ethics and principles of journalism. I know what our constitution is patterned after the United States. We have a Bill of Rights. We have freedom of the press. It is enshrined, and it is the foundation of every other freedom that Filipinos have. So I wasn't going to give up very easily, and I almost feel like my entire career was like going to the gym so that we could weather this moment and push through.
Are you seeing a light? Or is it, I mean, are you keeping hope alive? I mean, let's give our listeners something, you know, to look forward to.
Oh, the film ends on a very hopeful note, think, because I just feel like the tide is turning, right? Something will break. And as another woman in the film says, you know, that a president can't hijack your values, right? A president in the Philippines stays for one term, a 6-year term, and then he's out if he leaves.
That is the question.
But
been cases in the past where they said no, I don't want to.
Oh yes, of course. We had a
21 years
of Ferdinand Marcos.
Yes, Meldo, and that's the only one I've ever heard of in your country.
Yes, so he had then it was 2 4-year terms like the U.S. After his second term, he decided, you know, this is really nice. I love living in this presidential palace.
Right? Yeah,
and they stayed for another 13 years until 1986, which resulted in the People's Power Revolution.
This is the country that coined people power, right, in 1986, and here we are now.
So your election year would be 2022?
Correct. Yes.
And speaking of that, you do show the elections coming up and him getting his people in power in the Senate. Can you talk to that a little bit?
So the film is against the backdrop of the midterm elections of 2019. And so it was really key because the Senate was the only body he didn't really control. And at the end of that, as you saw in the end of the film, I'm giving it away.
No, it still goes, I mean, obviously, everybody's still going to go see this film.
Okay, at the end of the film, his slate, his people win all 12 seats. So he really controls all the branches of government now. So that's why it was really key for some opposition to show up, but they didn't, you know. I think it's also very similar here, where the opposition is fragmented and they didn't coalesce into one unit, and that was a problem. There was no opposition. And that's why President Duterte always says Maria is opposition, because she's the one speaking out against him, or Rappler is, right? Or one woman, Samira Gutok in the film, but she did ran against, you know, in the opposition slate, but she had no machinery. There's no money. And, you know, it's politics, right? You need a machine. You need money.
You need the backing.
Yes.
And
So is this battle just pretty much online, or what's the left of the legacy media? Something in print or traditional television broadcast? Do you have different political voices there, or all on one side?
What we saw, the first thing I think you'll see, and this will be familiar to you, is how easy it is to manipulate people, how disinformation changes reality, right? We didn't have, unlike the United States, we don't have the left and the right in the same way. All traditional media tended to stay in the middle. But over 6 months, the repeated, like, pounding of a fissure line, which is the gap between the rich and the poor, that was what they pounded. These are identity issues. You see it here, Black Lives Matter, where you'll see disinformation happening on both sides, right? In the Philippines, it was anyone who questioned the drug war was the first one, then the gap between the rich and the poor. And the end goal is to incite, to make you angry so you no longer are rational. You don't care. And the more facts that are thrown at you, the more entrenched you become. And it is so easy to mobilize you to act. And you'll see some of that. What we've had to weather, we've had to increase security 6 times in the time that Ramona was with us, right? And I think you'll see how fragile reality is. And I don't think Americans appreciate enough what a group like Cambridge Analytica did, because the president of Cambridge Analytica was in the Philippines meeting with Duterte's campaign team right before the campaign began, Alexander Nix. The most number of compromised accounts in the Cambridge Analytica scandal was in the United States. The country with the second most number is the Philippines. And the whistleblower actually said, Chris Wiley said, that the Philippines is the petri dish, that they tested tactics of mass manipulation, and if it worked, they ported it over to the United States and to Europe. So again, I will say, you know what happened to us? Oh, to answer your question, why did we stand up? Because Rappler is a startup run by journalists. I have no other business interest. None of us. There are 4 founders of Rappler that are there. And, you know, we were at the tail end of our career. You don't know who you are until you're tested. And what we found is that this is one of those times. We have no other business interest to protect. Go ahead, file the cases. And it goes way beyond online, because whatever is pounded online, a year later came out of President Duterte's mouth. The cases I face, I could go to jail for up to 83 years, another 20 years. Amal Clooney, who's one of my lawyers, actually like emailed me on Christmas Day saying, you know, we found another 20 years.
Great. I mean, there's your present, right?
This is insane.
And I don't think the president underestimated you guys, I think. I don't think the administration thought you would push back, right? Because I think he chose Rappler because Rappler was small and a startup and the new kid on the block. But it was also a combination of the new kid on the block headed by a very high-profile journalist, right? But I don't think he thought that you guys would push back so much, because it's also Rappler is also headed by 4 women, right? And they're mostly women, Rappler, young reporters. And I think they just underestimated you. I didn't think, I think they were surprised.
We're about 100 people now.
Oh, nice.
63% women. The median age is 23 years old. And I'm much, much older than 23. They could be my kids.
Just a tad.
Yeah.
Oh, great. So we're going to keep going here. You were talking about the trolling in the film, of how people are coming after you and your personal accounts. And do you have like the wall of the best ones of the people that have you know, the little snaps that they do on Facebook? Or it just is like the hate speech that's coming towards you is a part of the disinformation, right?
Yeah, I think this is a new weapon against journalists, and women are specifically targeted because, and it's similar. Our president, like yours, is sexist at best, misogynist at worst, and the kinds of attacks I've had to deal with after we came out with our first propaganda war series, and this was in 2016. I wrote 2 of the 3-part series, and, you know, one of the series talked about how Facebook algorithms impact democracy. The other one looked at how 26 fake accounts can actually influence up to 3 million others.
Yeah, you show that in a great chart in the film. Yep.
Yeah.
that's exponential, right? So it's like as a person, you have a devil and angel on your side, but the angel never gets to speak. Only the devil is telling you, hate, 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 hate. So I think I've been called every single animal. I've received every threat, beheading, burn her, kill her. You know, I got to a point where after that first series came out, I just stopped trying to respond and started counting the attacks coming in. And I had an average of 90 hate messages per hour. And the end goal was, of course, to make me doubt the reporting. And it did work, right? Because
it did get to you and doubting yourself and how you're reporting, or doubting that this reporting was doing any good.
I had to go back and over all the data again. Oh, okay. I doubted my figures, and I was like, oh my God. And actually, our managing editor said, Maria, you know, maybe you should stop writing, because when you're attacked, our entire company feels it. And she's right. So I did stop writing so that I could figure out what was going on. And the way we dealt with it was we took data, and we began we have more than a terabyte of data now that shows us the information ecosystem of the Philippines. The only other company that would have this is Facebook. And so we began to understand how you are being systematically attacked and manipulated by networks of disinformation, and that these local networks directly connect to things like the Internet Research Agency. When the United States Senate Intelligence Committee released the data on the IRA, the Russian disinformation networks, we were able to find our connection bottom up. So this is a global problem, and it preys on the worst of human nature, which is part of the reason politics, right? Politicians who don't want to incite hate, who don't want to use violence, who don't want to manipulate people, they don't know what to do. And I think that's part of the problem in the Philippines and here.
Yeah, the parallels are scary. And as you said, the petri dish that, you know, you guys are going forward and seeing this built, and how it's reflecting in countries like the UK, it's outrageous, I think. But
yeah, I think one of the most important lines in the film is actually what Amal says, you know, when she says that governments use the law, right? So there's a veneer of legitimacy. That's why all the cases against her. Now, of course, you know, it's stacked against her, but it still looks very legitimate. So that's how they are going after their opponents. So it's not a, you know, sledgehammer way of authoritarianism. It's more subtle and less obvious, and therefore scarier, because you don't know it's coming until you shine the light, until you start telling these stories. That's why I think it's important to tell these stories.
Are there any solutions? I mean, is there any the international online, you know, companies based in Silicon Valley or America, can they do anything about this?
Yes, they can, but will they, right? I mean, we know that.
Anybody?
What can they do, Maria?
Anybody got Mr. Zuckerberg's number?
You know, I met him in April of 2017. I was one of a small group of founders. We had lunch together, and then I talked to him on the side and invited him to the Philippines. I told him, look, at that point, 97% of Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. And he was frowning. And then I wondered why. And he said, Maria, where are the other 3%? It's now 100% since then. Look, what happens this year here? Always the Western, the American social media platforms put greater emphasis on the West. But the impact in countries like the Philippines or the Global South, where our institutions are so much weaker, we lost the checks and balances of our society within 6 months. Our institutions crumbled. So they must do something about it, because they're enabling the rise of authoritarian populist leaders all around the world. And we have a slew of solutions that they do need to, that they need to look through. They claim they're doing more, but frankly, it isn't enough.
We are speaking with Ramona Diaz of 1,000 Cuts. It's in the U.S. documentary competition here at Sundance this year. And she has brought along the star of the film, Maria Ressa Rappler, founder and extraordinary journalist in the Philippines. It's amazing to have been able to talk to you and enjoy your time here. Just the last bit, one of your documentaries before this was Don't Stop Believing in Every Man's Journey.
Yes, it does.
Right? And then I look at this documentary, such a more personal note for you. Do you want to just speak on that in the last minute here?
Yeah. It's seemingly epic, this film, but it is one of my more... I think it's my most personal film because I totally relate, I think, to Maria, right? She is both. She's also, for all intents and purposes, Filipino-American and lives with, in this liminal space I was talking about. And, you know, the thing she says in the film about really trying 100%, right, in order to deserve your place, I really relate to. So it is both epic and very personal.
Well, I appreciate you guys coming in today. Okay, where can I see the film?
Yes, you had your debut yesterday, as a matter of fact, but you're off to Salt Lake for a showing today, but around here on Monday, you're at the Redstone Cinemas at about 7 o'clock, and next Thursday at the Temple Theater in the afternoon, and you'll finish up on Friday at the Park Avenues Theater. So you got three or four showings ahead of you.
Yes, we just started.
Good luck.
Thank you very much
in the competition, and thank you again for coming to our small local news outlet.
Oh, our pleasure.
And sharing your time.
Thanks for having us.
Tune in and find out about some of the unknown and talented independent filmmakers from around the world. Join us for the Sundance Reel each weekday morning between 9 and 10. We'll highlight some of the most intriguing films being presented at this year's Sundance Film Festival. That's the Sundance Reel weekday mornings from 9 to 10 through January 31st, right here on KPCW or online, kpcw.org.
The Sundance Reel is brought to you in part by Sundance Institute, presenting the 2020 Sundance Film Festival from January 23rd through February 2nd. And Acura, proud 10-year sponsor of the festival and supporter of independent film and music. Learn more at acura.com.